lost himself, got himself back. There were entire emotional tomes in between those words.
All right, Declan said. So the city woke up for a while.
He hadn't told Adam about the sweet metals, and paranoid Declan was loath to give away more information, but he asked carefully, why do you think it has anything to do with Ronan? Could it be from a power source an outsider's bringing in? Adam frowned at him, and Declan was nearly certain he knew Declan was withholding information. Adam, as a secretive creature, understood secrets. But Adam just asked, how much do you know about what Ronan's been doing? Declan shook his head. He knew only that Ronan, Hennessy, and Bride were interfering with the moderator's attempt to kill other dreamers. That had seemed noble, useful, an acceptable outlet for Ronan's abilities and rebelliousness. Perhaps he had just wanted it to be. He'd wanted fewer ducklings for once. Adam said, there's no concrete evidence, but Ronan and the others have been implicated in over 20 incidents of industrial espionage. Surprise was not the emotion Declan was feeling, so some part of him must have known, suspected anyway. This was the other shoe dropping. What kind of industrial espionage? I got access to some of the agency's documents, Adam said casually. This, Declan thought, was why those kids in the waffle line couldn't truly be Adam's bosom friends. Adam was reading intelligence documents about his boyfriend, and they were Googling celebrity chefs. They've been taking down power grids, server farms, corporate waste sites. That power outage a few weeks ago, the one that affected those tens of thousands in Delmarva, that was them. Transmission line. The price tag is in the billions. Billions, echoed Declan. It was a lot to take in.
What's the goal?
The moderators don't know. Or at least they haven't put it in writing. I think I can guess, though. Overnight, I compared the dates and times of the espionage with the surges, and they match up. They match up exactly. I think Ronan and the others have been working to clear obstacles from the ley lines to make them stronger. Every time they do, that creates a chain reaction that means this line under Boston and Cambridge, this line that was dormant, it surges too. Has Matthew been having fewer of those strange episodes lately? Declan didn't know. He hadn't asked. Matthew hadn't said. Theoretically, Declan had been thinking nonstop about a sweet metal to secure his future. But actually, this was what Declan had been thinking nonstop about. Jordan Hennessy. I wouldn't be surprised, Adam said. He should be feeling great every time one of these surges happen. Declan didn't see the problem with that, and he said so. Adam pointed to the Beatles. You don't see a problem with that?
I see something that means eventually Matthew could stay awake on his own, am I right?
Adam's voice was patient, as if Declan were a child. Multiply that times thousands. Imagine a world where all the things the Ronan Lynches of the planet have dreamt over the years begin to wake up. Over the decades, centuries. Think about legends that could be talking about dreams. Think about all the monsters. Dragons. Minotaurs. How many of these things are just stories, and how many of those things were dreams that are sleeping now because the dreamers died long ago? Right now, Ronan's limited by how strong the ley line is. How many Ronans are there? What would they do without any limits? Stop thinking about Matthew for a second and think. And now it began to spool out in Declan's mind. A future where dreamers with ambition broke the economy, changed the art world, dreamt escalating weapons. Neil and Ronan's skill hadn't been threatening because it had been limited both by ability and by scope. They wanted to live in the world as it was, but someone with absolute power and no checks or balances, Declan thought, someone with ambition. This isn't just about keeping Matthew awake, Adam said. This is a bigger plan. This is a strategy.
That doesn't sound like Ronan.
Why do you think I said we needed to talk about Bride?
Declan, Adam said, the moderators have special psychics, visionaries, they call them. They've seen the future, and they think Ronan and the others are going to dream the apocalypse. That's why they're trying to kill him and Hennessy and Bride. They think they're going to end the world. Adam went on, his voice low. There's something out there. A thing that would end the world if it could. A kind of collective nightmare. I saw it the last time I scried. A dreamer could bring it back. They wouldn't even have to be trying to do it on purpose. You've seen what Ronan can do. Just one bad dream with enough lay energy to make it real, and then it's game over. The moderators have a point, is what I'm trying to say. Think about it. They have a point, and that's even if there's no bigger plan than just making the ley lines powerful again. For a moment, they were quiet. Declan sat on the concrete bench and looked back down the street at Harvard. He thought about how, at the beginning of the semester, Ronan had come here to look for apartments, and Declan had really believed that his loud brother might possibly live a quiet life like that for Adam's sake. "Has he called you?" Declan asked, knowing the answer already, not because of anything Adam had said, but because of all the things he hadn't. Adam just looked at him. "Do you trust Ronan?" Declan asked. His brother was many things, he thought, but murderer he was not. Even at his worst, it was only himself he'd wanted to destroy, and that hadn't seemed to be the Ronan he heard on the phone. Ronan's sin was immediacy, not villainy. Adam looked pensive. "I don't trust Bride." "That doesn't answer the question." But Adam just flicked the remaining beetle back under the bench and turned his face into the coming sunset. Declan understood then that Adam Parrish was allowing him not much closer than he'd let those friends in the waffle truck line. This was still just a corner of the situation. A very different corner than he would share with his Harvard buddies, but still, need-to-know basis. No more. Actual closeness and truth had been reserved for only one person, and Declan's relationship to that person was the only reason he was being given even this much of a look at Adam's concerns. "What do you want me to do about it?" Declan asked. Adam said, "Is he taking your calls?" 25. Growing up, the Lynch family hadn't talked about the dreaming. It seemed unfathomable now that their entire livelihood had been based upon dreams, that two-fifths of them had been dreams, that two-fifths of them had been dreamers, and yet they did not talk about it. Neil Lynch sold dreams on the black market, and Declan took calls from buyers for dreams, and yet they did not talk about it. Aurora was a dream, and Neil had always known that if something happened to him, the children would immediately become orphans of a sleeping mother, and yet they did not talk about it. Ronan accidentally dreamt a brother into being and had to teach himself how to prevent it from happening again, and yet they did not talk about it. Ronan had thought there was no one else like him in the world, and it had nearly killed him, and yet they did not talk about it. Looking back now, Ronan tried again and again to understand it from Neil and Aurora's point of view. Perhaps they thought the children would be less likely to betray the secret if they didn't have words for it. Perhaps they thought Ronan might grow out of the dreaming if he didn't pay attention to it. Perhaps they had lost trust in humans so thoroughly that they numbered their sons among the untrustworthy. He didn't remember the first time he'd dreamt something into being. He didn't remember dreaming Matthew. He did remember, however, one of the only times they talked about his dreaming. Ronan had been young. He didn't remember if Matthew existed yet. Memories were like dreams that way. They skipped the parts that weren't interesting to them at the time. He had been playing in the back fields at the barns, the deep sloping pasture that now contained the pond he and Adam had dug. He was young enough that he wasn't allowed out alone, so Aurora had been there with him, reading a book under the shade of a tree, laughing to herself every so often. How idyllic it must have been, he thought now, young Ronan tumbling through the waist-high grass, beautiful Aurora sprawled in one of her light tresses in the grass, hair golden as Matthew's or Bride's, a book in one hand, the other finding grapes out of the basket she'd brought with them. Overhead, the clouds in the summer blue had been as inviting and drowsy as an afternoon comforter. Ronan had fallen asleep. He did not remember this. He only remembered the waking. He remembered waking in the grass and being unable to move. Not his legs asleep, but all of him. His mind looking down at his body sprawled in the grass near his beautiful sweet mother. And then the memory skipped to him plucking something from the grass to show to Aurora. It was a book, like the one she'd been reading, but much smaller, sized for his child palms. "What do we have here?" she asked him, putting hers away. "Open it." Aurora let the tiny volume fall open. Inside there were not pages, but a summer sky graced with towering white clouds. She poked her fingers into the book and watched the clouds part around them. The sky was in the book, but it was also over the book, a page and a sky, two-dimensional and three-dimensional at once as it towered upward. "Look at you, Mr. Impossible," Aurora whispered fondly. She opened and closed it several times to see if the sky would change. It did, from day to night to day again, sun to stars to sun. "Now, let's bury it."
"Bury it," echoed Ronan. He wanted to show it to Declan, to Neil. He wanted to put it on his shelf. Aurora stood up and brushed the grass off her skirt.
"Little things like this are best as secrets. It's very important to remember that."
It didn't feel important to remember that. It felt important to show it to someone. Ronan tried to understand. "For how long?"
She kissed the top of his head. "Forever."
"Forever?"
"This seems like a really nice place," Hennessy said. "Are we here to destroy it?"
Burrito had just driven past acres of dried, unharvested cornfields to arrive at a house old enough to have a name on a brick pillar by the drive, Barn Hill. The cornfields went right up to a neat little yard, and then there was the square white house, and beyond that was dried marsh grass, and then presumably were marshes and eventually the sea. The entire property had a haunted, lonely loveliness. One would not find it by accident. Ronan agreed with Hennessy. It did seem like a really nice place. It reminded him of the barns, and he did not want to destroy it. Bride didn't answer, just gazed at the house as they pulled the invisible car up to the separate garage. He had not been quite the same since the server farm, although Ronan couldn't put his finger on what had changed. He wanted to say that it was something like an additional gravity, an investment in the task, but no one had ever been as invested in this as Bride. He seemed withdrawn from them, introspective. It was, Ronan thought, as if he were angry or disappointed with Ronan or Hennessy, although he couldn't think of what they might have done to vex him.
"Get your things," he said finally, already opening his door. "No, not just your sword, your bags."
"We're staying here?" Ronan asked in surprise. The lights were on inside the house, and it had a decidedly lived-in look to it. Not Bride's style. Not his style at all.
"If we're murdering people and taking their house," Hennessy said, "can I eat first? Actually, I guess I could eat them. I'm hungry enough to eat a baby. Are there going to be babies?"
But Bride was already off and nearly to the porch of the house, even more disinterested in her banter than he had been at the beginning of all this. With a growl, Ronan shouldered his bag in the scabbard with vexed to nightmare and followed after. By the time Hennessy climbed the two steps to the front door to join them, they could already hear footsteps from inside the house, lots of them. Ronan and Hennessy exchanged a look behind Bride's back. She looked as bemused as he did. Then the door opened and a short woman with light brown skin and dark brown hair clipped back from her face stood there. Even though her appearance had little in common with Hennessy's,
She nonetheless reminded Ronan of what Hennessy had looked like when he first met her, exhausted and frightened. Just like Hennessy, she hid the exhaustion and fright away beneath a very different expression, but it still leaked out around the eyes, the tight smile. When she saw them, a little bit of the exhaustion and fright went away, replaced with curiosity and wariness. Good, thought Ronan. That was the correct response to the three of them showing up on one's doorway. She looked bright up and down, and then she looked over her shoulder. Is this him? Behind her, several voices rose in a chorus of youthful excitement. He's here! Is it him? I said he was here. I said that already. It's Bride. What about Jordan Hennessy? Yes, I see her. I see her. And Ronan Lynch? He's tall and bald. He has a sword. The children had rushed up behind their mother like a wave blustering to shore, stopping just short of breaking out onto the porch. Five happy faces in five different heights. They hissed and poked at each other and pointed at Hennessy and Ronan standing behind Bride. Ronan and Hennessy exchanged another look. This was not what Ronan would have considered the correct response to the three of them showing up on one's doorway. But he kind of liked it. You might as well come in so they can paw at you, said the woman. Not that you're here for me, but I'm Angelica, Bride said as he stepped past her into the cramped hallway. Angelica Aldana Leon. Yes, I know. They told me. As her mouth dropped open, he lifted a closed fist and said to the five children, Presents, but not until you tell me what they are. Are they the seeds? Are you real? He said not to ask that. Bride opened his closed hand and let a single seed drop from it into each of their palms. Now, how do you make them grow? They conferred like it was a game show. Then one whispered the answer to the other, and together they clapped the seeds in their hands. Each immediately exploded into a bright blue lily, and just then Ronan realized, stupidly, that they were all dreamers, each of these children, and Bride must have come to them in their dreams, too, and shown them these dreamt seeds he was going to give them. Ronan searched inside himself for the same jealousy he'd first felt over Rhiannon, but that wasn't what he felt at all. The children told me that it's you who have stopped the... Angelica asked them, making a gesture to her eyes and nose. The night wash. The slop, shouted one of the boys. Thank you. Thank you so much. I don't know how to thank you for what you're doing, so just thank you. You have saved them, Angelica said with feeling. You're welcome, Bride said. I don't know how long it will hold, but we will keep working. Ronan stared at the kids, who stared back up at him. Now he understood why Angelica looked frightened and exhausted. Dreamers. Little dreamers, like he had been once, but growing up in a world where a lack of lay energy was killing them. He wondered how many dreamers had died of the night wash without knowing anyone else like them existed, or knowing that they could save themselves by moving to a place with more energy. This was why they were doing what they were doing. He looked down. One of the kids had his hand and was shaking it, trying to get him to follow. Another was giggling furiously as Chainsaw sat on her shoulder, working hard to be extraordinarily gentle with her talents. Same, Chainsaw, he thought. A third hugged his leg, and without thinking, he draped a hand over her head, his unconscious remembering both Matthew and Opal. He had forgotten what it was like to hug and be hugged during these last few weeks. It felt like ages since these small comforts. Angelica said something in brisk Spanish, and the children began to argue noisily among themselves. In English, she told them, The children will show you where you can put your things. I'm sorry. It is bunk beds for you two boys. We don't have much room. That's all right, Bride said. It will be nice to have a shower and a meal for a night. Hennessy was whisked away, and Bride and Ronan left in a bedroom with the promised bunk beds. There was nothing fancy about the beds. They were just raw wood screwed together with a can-do attitude and mismatched blankets. But the entire situation was homier than any place they had stayed since leaving.
Bride didn't seem to care. No sooner had he silently set his bag on the lower bunk than he turned to go. "Wait a second," Ronan said. "Wait a damn second." Bride paused, and Ronan nearly lost his nerve. He hadn't expected Bride to listen. "What did we do?" Ronan asked. Narrowing his eyes, Bride shook his head a little. Ronan pressed on. "Haven't we been trying? What more do you want from us? We go where you tell us to go. We do what you tell us to do. You asked me to listen, and I listened. What did I do? What did I fuck up?" Bride's expression changed. "I'm not angry with you. Is that what you think?"
"I don't know what to think."
"I don't either," Bride said. "Why does Adam keep trying to find you in the dreams these past few days?"
"Tam Quam."
"And why," Bride went on, "are you keeping him out?" Ronan felt his face go hot, his hands go cold. He hadn't thought Bride would notice.
"You don't know him. He can't put things down. He's thorough. He cares. The fact he found a way to look for me in dream space as soon as we started getting more energy out there just proves it. If I let him meet up with me in dream space, he won't stop researching the moderators and all of this stuff until he's solved it. I'm not going to be the one who gets him kicked out of Harvard."
"For his own good," Bride said, but not as if he believed or disbelieved, just as if he was anticipating the rest of Ronan's sentence. Then he looked away, and as he did, he had that same expression that had made Ronan think he was upset with them. His eyebrows set, eyes tight, mouth tight. Not as effortless as the bride they'd met all the weeks ago. In a low voice, he said almost to himself, "No, I'm not angry at you. You've done everything I've hoped. You and Hennessy are much different than I expected. Better than I expected." Ronan's mouth opened and closed. It was such the opposite of what he was expecting to hear that he didn't have any words at all. "No, I am not angry at you," Bride continued. "I'm tired. I'm proud. I'm confused. I'm sad. Because I know things can't stay like they are now. We are working even now to change things, and it will never be like this moment again. It is a ridiculous way to think, to be more interested in the present than the future, and if it were you or Hennessy, I would never permit it. I won't lose my way. I know that. But I can imagine it. It is me. It is me I am angry with." It meant more to Ronan than he thought to hear all these words, even if he didn't entirely understand them. "We are nearly to the final step," Bride said. "There is only the dam left. Then it will be a different game, entirely." "Why are we here then?" Ronan asked, and Bride's mouth turned rueful, which made Ronan think he had been expecting Ronan to ask something else, although he couldn't imagine what that something else might be. "This is just a reward. This is just so you can see why we're doing it, and sleep a night on a real pillow, and bask in the gratitude of one of the many voices who have your names on their lips these days. You're a hero. Enjoy it."
A hero? It was an unfamiliar concept. Ronan had been the villain for so long, if he had been anything. The one in trouble, the one written up on the slip, the one being chased, the one being accused. Before that, he had been the young dreamer. Secret. Forever. Now he was a hero to a family of young dreamers who would never have to feel alone. Both Bride and Ronan jumped as they heard a trilling sound. It was Ronan's dreamt phone. He had nearly forgotten he still had it. He hadn't used it since that first call to Declan. And it was Declan now. There was no way to identify the caller visually, of course, since the dreamt phone just looked like a tunnel piercing, but nevertheless, something about the ring strongly implied that it was Declan. It was a jarring interruption. Declan belonged to another world, a different timeline, but with a glance at Bride, Ronan tapped his finger against his ear to answer it. "Declo?"
"Good, it worked,"
Ronan said. "How did you do it?"
"I had to get back the car I was in when you called before and find your call and the previous calls and its log."
I couldn't type in that gibberish, of course, that showed up as your number, but I could just ask it to return your call. Wait, what car were you in before?
Declan didn't bother answering this. I want you to come to Mass this weekend.
It took Ronan a moment to parse the request. It was a quite ordinary one, one Declan had made countless times over the past several years, resulting in Ronan rolling his eyes and leaving very early in the morning in order to make it to 11 o'clock Mass with his brothers on the other side of the state. Now it felt like someone else's memories. A dream. It occurred to Ronan that something bad might have happened.
What's going on? Is Matthew okay?
Family meeting, Declan said, a Declanism that never failed to rankle.
Family meeting meant Declan shaking his finger at one of the other Lynch brothers.
About what?
About the future.
Are you fucking serious about Mass? That's in 2 days.
I have faith in you.
A lot of people are on our tail.
You tell us the church, the location, we'll be there.
Bride was waiting, eyebrow raised. My brothers want to see me, Ronan told him. It was making his pulse jack up for some reason, the thought of it or the thought of telling Bride about it. He couldn't tell which.
This weekend.
Declan asked, who are you talking to? Is that Bride?
We have a date with Illadora, Bride said in a low voice.
I have to think about it, Ronan told the phone. I'm not close to Boston.
What's important to you? Declan asked. I wouldn't be asking if it wasn't important.
Bride was still looking with his same expectant expression, hand on the doorknob to go to the dreamers they'd come to see.
I have to go, Ronan said. I'll call you back. He hung up.
He thought he grasped what Bride had just been talking about before the call, because he, too, felt somewhat torn between the possibility of seeing his brothers again for a few minutes and the knowledge that the dreamers were nearly to the end of the first part of this endeavor, and whatever would change once the final obstacle to Illidoran's line was removed.
I won't tell you what to do, Bride said, but I need to go on after this. I can't stop this close to the end.
I know, Ronan replied. It was complicated to be a hero.
26.
Matthew was walking. Not wandering this time, but walking determinedly.
Declan had told him he'd talk to Ronan and to stay put while he went out to take care of errands. He hadn't said the two things were connected, but Matthew guessed they were. He'd had to guess, because no matter what Matthew said, Declan still failed to have real conversations with him. He confided in Jordan if he confided in anyone, and just kept pointing out dogs to Matthew.
This filled Matthew with bad feeling, and the bad feeling, on top of all his previous bad feeling, set him to walking. Not wandering. Walking. Like a human. Not a dream.
He marched, hands stuffed in the pockets of his bright blue puffer jacket, head down. Watching his sneakers slap one in front of the other just made him walk faster and harder, dark pavement and sidewalk disappearing beneath them. Declan thought these big white sneakers were ridiculous. Matthew knew that now. He hadn't when he'd bought them, all excited about having put away enough money.
Aren't they super? He'd said, and Declan had murmured,
they are the most memorable pair of shoes I've ever seen.
And at the time, Matthew had thought that meant Declan loved them as much as he did. How stupid he'd been, he thought, his ears burning red. How stupid he'd always been about everything. Even the idea that Matthew had been excited about finally acquiring enough money to get the shoes was ridiculous. The money was from a weekly allowance that came from doing chores, a system started by Aurora back at the barns and continued by Declan even after they moved to the townhouse. Matthew had never questioned the correctness of this. Yes, of course he received an allowance for cleaning his room, vacuuming, unloading the dishwasher, spraying pine cleaner on the townhouse's front door to get the pollen off, cleaning the trash out of Declan's Volvo after school. God, he couldn't bear thinking about it. He just couldn't bear it. It had just been Declan's money. Just an older brother giving pocket money to a stupid little kid who stayed stupid even once he got big. All Matthew's friends at school got jobs bussing tables and working cash registers, and Matthew got bills in a mug on the kitchen counter. And now it was no different. He just collected the allowance from gallery owners who gave him odd jobs as a favor to Declan, because they thought Declan Lynch's kid brother was cute and his love of ugly sneakers was funny. Matthew kept walking, walking, stomping. He walked right out of their neighborhood, past restaurants bustling with diners and comely brick grow houses bright in the evening, by a little convenience store that reminded him of the one Declan had sometimes stopped at back at home when he forgot to get milk during the week. He thought about the times they'd just sat there for several long minutes, with Declan staring off at nothing with the receipt for the milk pressed between his hand and the steering wheel. "Aren't we going home?" Matthew would ask. "Play your game," Declan would reply. And Matthew did. He just played whatever stupid game he had on his phone while his older brother sat there at a gas station 5 minutes from home for sometimes nearly an hour rather than going back to the townhouse. And Matthew had never once asked him why they were sitting there or what Declan was thinking about or if he hated everything about his life. And now this thing about sweet metals, this thing they were supposedly pursuing to keep Matthew safe while not talking to him about any of it. Everyone still acted like he was just a pet. Matthew's feet kept on marching him along, farther from home. Home, with quotation marks, because home, without quotation marks, was either the barns or the D.C. townhouse. Home was a Fenway apartment Matthew thought of as old man eyebrows because of how the detail work over the windows looked like fat, frowning eyebrows. It had 7 rooms, which Matthew had mentally named. Twice, once after the 7 dwarves, and once after the 7 vices. Happy Gluttony was the kitchen. Bashful Sloth, the living room. Grumpy Lust, Declan's bedroom. So on, so forth. Declan liked the apartment. Matthew could tell Declan liked it. He liked everything about his life here, even though Matthew wasn't exactly sure what his life here even entailed. He didn't talk to Matthew about it. Declan didn't say he was happier, but he clearly was happier. It made Matthew feel kind of bad inside. Enormously bad inside. He didn't know why. His feet had taken him to a part of the city that seemed to be nearer to the water and farther from people and businesses. Beside him was a raised bit of highway that just ended in midair with weeds beneath it, ready for an action scene. Declan would have been extremely displeased to find him here. But when Matthew learned he was a dream, Declan had told him that he was just as much a Lynch brother as the other two. But Matthew knew now that wasn't true, because he wasn't being sent to school. He wasn't being prepared for a future. He was being tended and loved and managed. The thing about this life of Declan's, Matthew thought, the thing about it was that Matthew was just a thing in it, a dream object, a puppy to be walked and then returned to home with some of the energy burned off. His eye was caught by an unoccupied crane, a spiffy one. It had one of those big boom things that looked like a ladder, and at the top of it was a hook. Matthew thought without hesitation, "I'm going to climb that." He did. He clambered onto the body and then onto the boom, up and up and up. He thought how annoyed Declan would be. "Good," he thought. "Good, good." "But I told you to stay in the house," Declan would say, confused. "You're supposed to stay exactly where I put you, like a toy." He kind of wished he'd never found out he was a dream. At the top of the crane boom, Matthew closed his eyes. He used to imagine that air was a hug that was always happening, but he couldn't seem to conjure up that happy thought right then. It had taken Matthew a long time to understand that he was a boat anchor in Declan's life. "Crumbs!" Opening his eyes, he realized there was a tiny person looking up at him, a tiny Jordan. Well, a regular-sized Jordan. Far below, she shielded her eyes. "Yeah,"
I thought that was you.
You can't make me come down, Matthew told her.
I sure as shit cannot, she agreed. But it's harder to talk this way, you up there, me down here.
Don't talk to me like a kid. I can tell you're talking to me like a kid, and I don't like it. Jordan crossed her arms, a posture readable even from up on a crane.
All right, here you go then. Climbing up on a stick into the sky is a stupid way to process any kind of problem. But stupid's your right, so if you want to stay up there, just let me know how long it'll be so I can know if I have time to get a drink or if I should just hang here.
Why do I need to be watched at all?
Because you climbed a crane, mate.
Matthew considered this, and then considered it some more, and then with a sigh, climbed down to where Jordan waited. How did you know I was here?
You walked right by my studio. You didn't recognize it?
He hadn't, stupid.
What's the deal here?
Jordan asked as they began to walk back the way he'd come.
Are you giving Rebellion a go? Is this about your brothers lying to you?
Because she just said it instead of mincing around it, Matthew told her. He told her everything. All the things that were bothering him, from big to small and back to big again.
That all sounds truly fucked up, and I'm sorry,
Jordan said, opening the door to Fenway Studios. Together they walked down the hall toward the studio she stayed in.
The problem, as I see it, is that some of that shit's about being a dream, but some of it's just about growing up. And honestly, both are sorry situations if you ask me about it.
I did, Matthew said.
You did what, mate?
Ask you about it. She laughed her enormous laugh as he smiled at her. She lightly high-fived him and then pushed open the door to let them into the studio.
Ah, yeah.
Whoa, Matthew said. This is good. Since he'd been last, Jordan had accomplished huge amounts of work on her copies of El Jaleo and Madame X. Each canvas had a separate, smaller easel sitting in front of it with reference photos and jotted palette notes and instructions and business cards taped all over them. But what he was looking at was the work she'd done on the portrait of Sherry and her daughter, the one he'd helped her with at the very beginning. It was still coming together, but their faces were very good, and the colors were as understated and lovely as the John White Alexander painting she had taped on the easel beside it.
Thanks, Jordan said.
They're way better than this other weird stuff. The rest of the studio was full of the ordinary studio occupants' work, colorful, elongated nudes with cucumber-shaped breasts.
Not really, Jordan said. I mean, Sargent's better than Sir Tits here is, obviously. That's why Sargent's famous, and this guy is just, you know, this guy. But these paintings of mine are copies. At least this guy is making original stuff. That's part of it, I think.
I don't know much about sweet metals, but I know I'll never make one painting Sargent's.
Matthew moved Jordan's pillow to sit on the bright orange couch.
So what do you think will do it?
She perched on the arm.
It's what that guy said, isn't it? Boat fellow, the one your brother took us to see. The art's got to do something to the artist. It's more about making it than what gets made. It changes them, I guess. If you're a bang-up artist who always paints great work, it doesn't mean anything when you make another great work. It's got to be something else. Not trauma, exactly. It's more like energy and movement. One makes the other. There's movement in their life, their technique, somehow, that captures that lay energy. It's movement. I guess. I don't know, really. I'm talking out my ass, and if my voice sounds desperate to you, it's because of that. It's coming from my ass.
Matthew liked that she was talking to him like he was a real person.
So you think making an... not copy, an original, will make a sweet metal for you?
Because you always do copies? She pointed at him, snapping her fingers. Right, right. That's what I'm hoping. But I just won't know if it works until I need it, will I? I've been working on an original, that painting of your brother, but I can't tell, sitting here, if it's working. I can't feel any of the sweet metals the same way these past few days, actually, because of whatever Hennessy and Ronan are doing with the ley line. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed you've had fewer of the episodes? Matthew was so relieved to hear her say it, like it was just a normal, commonplace thing. I haven't been wandering. Right? When I first got here, I felt the sweet metal so strongly. I could feel El Jaleo doing something to me. I guess because I needed it. Now it feels like there's more energy to be had all around. So I just feel normal when I see it. I mean, I love it, yeah, sure. But I don't know if I'd be able to tell it was any different than any ordinary painting if I saw it for the first time today. So I can't feel if my painting is getting there or not.
You could get another dream, Matthew suggested. A sleeping one, from a dead dreamer. Back at the barns, there's loads of my dad still, probably.
That's a really good idea. She sounded like she really meant it, too.
Because of this, he felt bold enough to ask, Can I see it?
What? Oh, the painting? You know he hasn't seen it yet.
Yeah.
You'd be the only person besides me to see it.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. But my ego is very fragile about it. So maybe don't tell me anything bad about it. Maybe don't say anything at all. Just grunt, and then I'll put it away real quick.
Yeah.
The high-ceiling studio had a little half-balcony. She retrieved a large canvas from it, and then, making a face, turned it around at the bottom of the stairs for him to see. Matthew looked at it a long time.
Never mind. Say something. Silence is much worse, Jordan told him, and Matthew liked this, too, because it made him feel like she cared about what he thought.
Does Declan know what it looks like, even a little? He asked.
When she shook her head, he looked at it a bit longer, and then he said, Are you going to marry my brother?
Crumbs, man, you go hard. I thought you'd say the foreground was too busy or that I'd gotten his nose wrong.
Matthew asked, Why does he treat you like you're real? Jordan looked at him for a long time, as long as he'd looked at the painting, and then she took away the portrait of Declan to the second floor again. When she came back down, she crouched in front of him and said, Because I am real.
How do you know?
Because I'm talking to you, mate. Because I have thoughts and feelings of my own. It doesn't matter how you got here. You are here.
Matthew stared at his hands. What if Ronan made me this way? What if he made me how I am?
So what if he did? She took his hand and jiggled it. Why do you think Declan's got his curls? Why do you think Ronan's an asshole? We all get handed things from our parents. We all have bodies that obey rules that we deal with. We're not as different as you think.
Matthew could feel himself retreating from this last sentence as fast as he'd walked away from old man eyebrows.
Look, I'm not trying to tell you it's easy, Jordan said, to deal with this, with being a dream.
I just mean... If you're thinking, this is the magic thing that explains why everything's weird and wrong and why it's so hard to figure where I fit, well, it doesn't solve things like that. We're not different in ways that matter. Your boy Declan just pretends it matters so he doesn't have to think too hard about his mom and how he feels about that. And because he's afraid that if you're a real person, you'll grow up and leave him, and then he won't have a family, and he won't know who he is. There. There's your $2 therapy session. I don't know if it's for you or for him, but maybe you can split the cost.
You're pretty cool, Matthew said.
Oh, yeah, I am. She lightly high-fived him again. So, what do you think of my painting?
Matthew pointed to a long orange breast on the closest canvas.
I think it's better than that one. Jordan laughed gleefully. Hey, I see a smile on that face. You happier then?
Matthew thought about it.
Yeah.
It was better than happiness, actually. For the first time since he'd found out he was a dream, he felt like himself again.
27. Hennessy remembered sitting for Jordan in white. Jay had spent the morning crying at a mirror on the second floor of their London row house, and Hennessy had spent the morning watching her through the cracked door. She'd drawn the shape of her mother into the shag rug she sat on, and wiped it out again and again, trying to perfect the slope of her shoulders, the bend of her neck. It was difficult to tell if Jay had been truly crying, or if she were crying for reference. She was taking photos of it with her phone in the mirror, and then rapidly typing something into it. After a few hours of this, Jay emerged without warning, and although Hennessy scrambled away to prevent discovery, her mother found her wrapped in the linen curtain at the end of the hall. "Little ghost," she said to Hennessy, "let's go to the studio." Hennessy was rarely allowed into the studio, and certainly never invited, so it was with awe she accepted her mother's hand and rode the elevator to the third floor studio. There was nothing quite like J.H. Hennessy's studio when she was in the prime of her career. This secret world was accessible only via the coded elevator, or via a dark staircase that ended at a door with no knob, just a key in a lock. Inside, it was old and new. Elderly window sashes, sleek white walls, old floorboards, new black and white graphic floor paint. From the ceiling hung immense light fixtures, gifts from a fellow artist, messes of light bulbs and dried grasses and leaves. From the floor grew metal floor lamps with shades cut sharply so that they threw light in geometric lacy shapes. Gradient thumbprints dotted every flat surface, including the white grand piano where Jay had thoughtlessly tested new paints. And of course there were the paintings in all states of finish. The eyes were alive. The hands were alive. Once the elevator door had hissed closed behind them, Jay took just one moment to look out one of the studio's windows for something, and then, when she didn't find it, she returned to make a great fuss over Hennessy. She had her try on several of the dresses she had thrown on the sofa. She posed her in multiple ways in a simple wooden chair. She messed with her hair and played at braids and put lipstick on her and wiped it off. All the while she told Hennessy how pretty she had grown up to be, how wonderful a painting they were going to make together. No, not a painting, a series of paintings, an exhibition. It had felt like a day that happened to someone else. Hennessy sat very still in the chair, like an animal by a highway, afraid to move lest she dart from safety to something worse. She was cold in the white shift, but she didn't want to even shiver in case her mother remembered. Hennessy was not usually treated like this. But the spell hadn't broken. They'd worked all day, all evening. The next morning, Jay was still enthused. She ordered in a very grand breakfast of pastries from one of the bakeries, and then they went back up for more work, this time up the rickety back staircase that ended in the door with no knob. They spent 2 weeks like that, with Hennessy sitting still in the chair and not shivering, and her mother painting her, and takeaway and delivery bags piling up in the stairwell. At one point, Jay put her brush down and said, shocked,
I made you. One day, you'll grow up and be a woman, and I made you. Jay looked at Hennessy, and Hennessy suddenly had the impression that Jay was really seeing her, really thinking about what it meant to be Hennessy, to be Hennessy's mother. Jay looked from Hennessy to a painting and back again. Then she said, "How wonderful you're going to be." It was the best moment of Hennessy's life. Then there was an audible slam. The front door. Bill Dower, returning from wherever he had gone. Jay leapt up so quickly that her stew clattered on the floor. Her still wet palette was abandoned on the piano. The elevator door was whirring closed. Hennessy was alone before she even quite understood what had happened. She sat in the chilly chair for quite a while, not wanting to move in case her mother returned. After an hour, she pulled up the drop cloth to wrap around herself and wait some more. Little ghost. Finally, she let herself shiver and admit Jay wasn't coming back. With a little sigh, she padded barefoot across the cold floor to the elevator, but discovered it wouldn't move without the code, which she didn't have. She went to the door without a knob instead, but it wouldn't open. It was locked. The keyhole was empty. Hennessy was trapped in the studio. At first she called down very nicely, though she didn't think either of her parents would hear her over their own raised voices. Then she shouted. She banged. Finally, she gave up. She waited. It became night. Hennessy wiped away her tears and turned on the floor lights, which threw hard, lacy patterns across the floor and walls. She went to see the canvas her mother had worked on all these weeks. It was awful. It was the worst painting Hennessy had ever seen her mother do. It was twee and cutesy, a straightforward and boring portrait of a daft, plucky little girl sitting awkwardly on a chair. The eyes weren't alive. The hands weren't alive. Hennessy, who'd been working and learning with her own art all this time, was embarrassed for her mother. It was terrible that she wasn't coming up here for Hennessy and her growling stomach, but it felt even more terrible that anyone would ever see this piece. Hennessy looked at the canvas for a long time, and then she counted, telling herself that if one of her parents came for her by the count of 600, she wouldn't do it. 600 seconds went by. 800. 1,000. Hennessy stopped counting. She searched the drawers by the wall and collected all the paints she wanted. Then she moistened her mother's oils again on the palette, picked up the brush, and began to paint. After a few minutes, she dragged over the full-length mirror from beside the sofa, and she redid the portrait's gormless face with her actual, wary expression. She overpainted the boring shadows and the white shift with subtle colors instead. She shrugged the shoulders of that chilly girl just a little, not quite shivering, but wanting to. At each step, she got up to compare her brushstrokes to the other paintings in the studio. She made the eyes alive. She made the hands alive. She painted the portrait that Jay should have painted. It took all night. It was a J.H. Hennessy by way of Jordan Hennessy. It was another day after that before her mother came to get her. And by then Hennessy was fitful and burning up with a fever that had come on during the second night. Bill Dower had gone again. "This turned out better than I thought,"
Jay said, looking at the canvas, hovering her fingers over her signature in the corner, painted by Hennessy hours before.
Oh, Jordan, stop complaining. I've got some paracetamol downstairs. Come on, what a trial. Next time, don't hide so long, and you won't feel as awful.
Hennessy's first forgery was of herself. Sitting in the basement of Aldana Leon's house, crisscross applesauce on the roll-up mattress, Hennessy took out her dreamt phone and held it in her lap. She looked around the dim basement. It was stacked densely with cardboard boxes, a family that had either not yet unpacked from a move or was packing for one. One corner had been reserved for a small desk covered with tubes of poster paints and cheap brushes. There were a few pieces of rippled paper there that had been painted on, and some child had painted the top of the desk instead. Hennessy respected that child. With a shiver, Hennessy told her dreamt phone to call Jordan. It rang for nearly a minute, and then, "Jordan Hennessy," Jordan said politely, not recognizing the caller ID. "Hello?" Jordan's voice hit her like a sack of stones. Hennessy's best forgery, Jordan by way of Hennessy. All those years together. All the other girls dead. Why hadn't Hennessy called her before now? How had she forgotten how Jordan was the only thing that ever made this feeling inside Hennessy go away? This awful dread. This feeling of the lace, even when she was awake. Hennessy hadn't spoken yet. She didn't know what to say. On the other side of the line, a bland voice sounded in the background.
"I'm getting it to go. It's faster that way, even with the walk. Do you want Baba Ganoush or no?"
Declan Lynch. Declan Lynch. Why was she surprised to hear his voice? She'd known Jordan had left in his car weeks and weeks before. Jordan's words were slightly muffled as she turned from the phone. "If you're paying, yes. Get me every side dish they have." Then back to the phone.
"Sorry, who's this? I don't know you're coming through very well. I can't hear you."
This voice, the one she was using on the phone, was a very different voice than the one she'd just used for Declan Lynch. She'd used her outside, professional voice to talk to the phone, her inside, real voice to talk to Declan Lynch. Hennessy and her girls were the only ones who used to get the second one. They'd been the only ones who were important. Hennessy's cheeks felt hot.
"Hello,"
Jordan said, then to Declan.
"No, a crank caller, I guess, or a bad connection. One doesn't like to assume malice."
"Safer to assume," Declan said dryly, and Jordan's laugh faded as she pulled the phone away from her head. Hennessy hung up. She sat back on the mattress. She let herself think it. This is what she's always wanted. It wasn't that Hennessy had wanted Jordan to be unhappy in her absence. After all, Hennessy was the one who'd insisted Jordan go with Declan in the first place, right? Her memories were muddy. She could hear a little voice suggesting Jordan had actually come up with the idea, but carefully worded it so Hennessy would think it was hers. Was that true? She thought about going upstairs to find Ronan. He would remember. He was there that night. But finding Ronan meant finding Bride, too, because they were together in the bunk bedroom, and also because the two of them were inseparable. And Bride would just try to spin her current misery into a lesson. Hennessy didn't think she could take any more lessons. The basement was cold. She pulled up the sheet around her to cover her shoulders and, just like that, was transported to her memory in Jay's studio. Little ghost. What if Jordan stopped loving her? What if she'd never loved her, only needed her? What if Hennessy had lost the only real thing in her life by running off to chase dreams with Bride and Ronan Lynch? What was she doing here? They weren't a company of three dreamers. Bride and Ronan were one thing. Hennessy was something else. Hennessy was so tired of being alone. She was so tired. She turned the phone over in her hands. Even the phone was a reminder of how little she belonged here. If not for Ronan, it wouldn't be a phone in her hands. It would be the lace, just like at Rhiannon Martin's farm. Angrily, she tapped through the options, looking to see what her subconscious and Ronan's subconscious had dreamt into it. Contact numbers, speakerphone, text messaging, timer. Before Ronan and Bride, Hennessy had always set a timer before she fell asleep. 20 minutes. That was the longest she could sleep before starting to dream. Eventually, she had to set the timer while she was awake, too, because it turned out that sleeping without dreaming eventually left one prone to drifting off even while painting or driving. This phone's timer had only one setting, 20 minutes. Was it her subconscious or Ronan's that had guessed she might come looking for it at some point? Which one of them hadn't trusted her? She wondered if she could go back to that life. Everything seemed imaginary with that little sleep. Surely it had been worse than this reality. Surely. Hennessy tried not to think about the sound of Jordan's voice. She tried not to think of the sound of her voice talking to Declan. Little ghost. Hennessy was haunting Jordan's life. She knew which of them was the more vital Jordan Hennessy. The hideous feeling grew and grew in her. She knew if she went to Ronan and Bride, they'd whisk her off into a dream full of impossible things, thinking this would remind her of the joy of dreaming. They never considered how it only reminded her of the joy of their dreaming. Now she needed to deal with this herself. She just wanted to put this feeling down for a few minutes. Everyone else in the world could sleep it off. Not Hennessy. It was always the lace. Always going to be the lace. Closing her eyes, Hennessy thought back to that last time she'd seen Jordan. She ignored the little mean voice. She was sure Jordan hadn't wanted to leave Hennessy. She was sure it had been Hennessy's idea to send her off with Declan for safekeeping. She was sure Jordan had believed in her. She was sure. Shrugging off the sheet, Hennessy climbed off the mattress. She didn't set the timer. Instead, she asked her phone to show her one of John White Alexander's paintings. He was one of their favorites, Jordan and Hennessy. Hennessy and Jordan. She went to the desk covered with art supplies, squeezed some paint out, and picked up one of the brushes. Then she began to do one thing, at least, that she knew she was good at, forging someone else's brilliance. 28. Ronan woke with a start. He was in the top bunk in the room he was sharing with Bride. It was still dark. He rolled over quietly to see if Bride was sleeping. The lower bunk was empty, the blankets tossed aside. Ronan grabbed his jeans from where they were tossed at the end of his bunk, his jacket from the plastic unicorn head on the wall, and his boots from beside the door. He stepped quietly into the dark hallway. Bride crouched there over a collapsed form. Matthew. One of Matthew's hands was palm up, and in it was a little figurine of a hawk. He was obviously dead. What did you do? Ronan snarled.
Correlation is not causation, Ronan Lynch, Bride said. Adam appeared briefly at the end of the hall and just as quick was gone.
What did you do?
Bride said. Wake up.
Ronan woke with a start. He was in the top bunk in the room he was sharing with Bride.
It was still dark. He rolled over quietly to see if Bride was sleeping. The lower bunk was empty. The blankets tossed aside. Ronan grabbed his jeans from where they were tossed at the end of his bunk, his jacket from the plastic unicorn head on the wall, and his boots from beside the door. He stepped quietly into the dark hallway. Bride crouched there over a collapsed form.
Matthew!
One of Matthew's hands was palm up, and in it was a little figurine of a hawk. He was obviously dead.
What did you do? Ronan snarled.
Correlation is not causation, Ronan Lynch, Bride said.
Adam appeared briefly at the end of the hall, and just as quick was gone.
What did you do?
Bride said.
Wake up.
Ronan woke with a start. He was in a top bunk in the room he was sharing with Bride.
It was still dark.
He rolled over quietly to see if Bride was sleeping. Bride was already standing by the bunk, eye to eye with Ronan, somehow less like himself, frighteningly close. He didn't smile, but he was all teeth. He said,
"Whose dream is this?"
Ronan woke with a start. He was in the top bunk in the room he was sharing with Bride. Full white winter daylight streamed in the window. It was quiet, but nonetheless Ronan had that feeling one sometimes has on waking, the feeling of having been woken by a sound, in this case, a scream.
He lay there in bed for a few seconds, listening, waiting. And now it sounded instead like a very intense conversation was happening deeper in the house. He listened to it long enough to feel he was awake, or at the very least that this dream was going to be different from the previous ones. He got dressed and headed out. There was no one on the first floor where school supplies spread across the dining room table, so Ronan descended to the basement. It took him a moment to absorb the full picture. There was a painting of a woman in a swirling blue dress completely covering 12 of the stacked boxes. Not dreamt, done with real paint, some of it still a little dark and damp. The desk, tucked beside the boxes, held bottles of cheap school paints and paper plates with childish smiley faces drawn on them. Hennessy must have been painting with the children. The cheap school colors didn't seem like they should combine to the sophisticated work on the boxes, but this wasn't magic. This was Hennessy. This was what she was good at, what she was great at. Hennessy stood in front of her cardboard mosaic, one hand pressed up against the roses tattooed round her throat, looking at the ground. There was vomit on the ground in front of her. Bride was there, blood all up and down one arm with no sign of where it was coming from. He stood silent as Angelica screamed in his face. The children were all crying. Katie was curled up small, her arms linked around her leg braces, whimpering. Yesenia was sobbing and occasionally babbling, hoarse when she did. Stephen was trying to look stoic as he watched Angelica let Bride have it, but his mouth was crumpled and his chin dimpling in a way that reminded Ronan uncomfortably of when Matthew was upset. Wilson and Anna clung to Angelica, faces buried in their mother's shirt. There was blood on her clothing, too.
"What the hell?" Ronan said, but his words were lost in the cacophony.
"Accidents happen," Bride said, "and surely you can tell by looking at her she didn't mean to do it."
"It doesn't matter that it is an accident," Angelica barked back. "Traffic collisions are accidents. That doesn't mean I send my children to play in the street."
"I was only a minute behind her in the dream," Bride pointed out. "They were never in danger."
Angelica swept her arm over the children.
"You and I have a very different definition of danger. I saw those things. That thing. I saw it. It..."
Her anger had to disappear for a moment as she choked down a horrified half-sob. Hennessy looked up at Ronan, her expression quite calm, but when she blinked, two tears immediately broke free and raced down her cheeks. Then Ronan got it.
She'd taken out the lace. Bride had dispatched it somehow, but Ronan knew that didn't really matter in the relative scheme of things. The injury of the lace wasn't whatever sparring had caused that blood. It was the mere existence of the lace. It was that before you saw the lace, you didn't know something like the lace could exist. Especially if you hadn't known before that minute that anything could hate you that much. Especially if you hadn't known before that minute that you could hate yourself that much. Katie had stopped whimpering and was staring off at nothing, her eyes lost. Hennessy looked at Ronan and shook her head as another tear escaped.
"I'm so sorry," she told Angelica. "I'm so sorry. I'm so..."
"Who are you to have that in your head?" Angelica said. Then her eyebrows sort of got themselves together and her entire expression got harder.
Ronan could tell that whatever she said next was going to be absolutely true and would absolutely destroy Hennessy. Before she could say it, Bride held up a hand. He turned to Ronan and Hennessy.
"Get your things, then get in the car."
"Why?"
Hennessy asked in a hollow voice.
"Actually, forget your things. I'll get them. Just get in the car,"
Bride ordered. He turned back to Angelica, and as they left, Ronan heard him say,
"You might remember that dreamer was a child once, too, not very long ago."
Outside the car, Hennessy stopped dead and simply stared at it and through it. It was not because it was invisible. She was staring at and through everything in front of her.